Okay, so we continue with this third chapter on practices and perspectives. And that theme of relinquishing, letting go of attachment, letting go of conceiving, and the, to the point where even the appreciation for the Dhamma has to be toned down. At least it's not relinquished or given up, but it's sort of one can't be enthralled with it. So there is a relinquishment there, and it continues. In fact, the act of abandoning that occurs at awakening is so radical that it can be expressed only in enigmatic terms. And this is a quote that Ajahn Amaro used in the chapter, just a couple of days ago, Sangita 1, Sutta number 1. I mean, it's which kind of, I think, emphasizes the importance of this this short little sutta. Anyway, I'll read it. Sangyutta 1, Sutta number 1. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Savatthi in Jetus Grove in Atapindika's park. Then, when the night had advanced, a certain devata of stunning beauty illuminating the entire Jetus Grove approached the Blessed One. Having approached, he paid homage to the Blessed One, stood to one side, and said to him, "How, dear sir, did you cross the flood?" "By not halting, friend, and by not straining, I crossed the flood." "But how is it, dear sir, that by not halting and by not straining, you crossed the flood?" "When I came to a standstill, friend, then I sank. But when I struggled, then I got swept away. It is in this way, friend, that by not halting and by not straining, I cross the flood." And that is Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. So that the sense of, again, the sense of, balance, I guess, is maybe the best way to emphasize it. And that the you can't just sort of bash your way through, but you can't really stop and do nothing either. So it's just this sense of really a fine tuning. And then the original Pali contains there's a bit of a paradox in the sense of the one is the word that is without staying in place or by not straining, apattitang, staying in place, unestablished. The Buddha's reply is intended to be paradoxical, for one normally crosses a flood by halting in places that offer a foothold and by straining in places that must be crossed. So if you're dealing with the reality of a flood, then the Buddha is sort of turning it upside down and saying, okay, you have to approach this differently. Anyway, Tanisaro's translation is, "I crossed over the flood without pushing forward, without staying in place or unestablished. But how, dear sir, did you cross over the flood without pushing forward, without staying in place? When I pushed forward, I was whirled about. When I stayed in place, I sank. And so I crossed over the flood without pushing forward, without staying in place." So that, the theme of balance, of course. It's come up many, many times, and that's is kind of the essence of the middle way. The elaborations.
Well, I think it says everything. That it's a kind of it's often when there's self view, like I'm going to push forward, or I should I should be really careful here. And it's that often what makes us stand still or stop or overdo it is where that's coming from a place of self-view. But when there's an attunement to the time, the place, the situation, there's a vigorous engagement, but it's not conceptual, it's not self-based, then like a tightrope walker, you know, it's not a concept. It's a balancing act.
Yeah, there's that. Remember that video of the guy who did the tightrope between the twin towers,
yes,
in New York. He said he got to such a zone of kind of balance that he was just sort of going back and forth, and the police are
at both ends.
At both ends, and he's just sort of going back and forth and doing this and that, and he's just having a great old time.
400 feet
up. You know, whatever, way up between the twin towers in New York. Yeah, then that's a similar kind of balance that we need to be attending to. Ajahn Chah similarly has used a paradoxical way of speaking to express the same point. And this is from Food for the Heart. What I'll do is actually just read the excerpt, and then I'll read the whole talk because it's just get the context of the whole talk. To put it another way, going forward is suffering, retreating is suffering, and stopping is suffering. Not going forward, not retreating, and not stopping. When that happens, is anything left? Body and mind cease here. This is the cessation of suffering. Hard to understand, isn't it? So he is. and this is from this collection, which was done by Wisdom Publications, Food for the Heart. And it's titled The Four Noble Truths. And it's a talk that was given at Manjushri Institute. In the notes, it says 1977, but I'm pretty sure it was 1979.
Yeah, I think that's correct. Yeah. Yeah.
And at that Manjushri Institute is a Tibetan center that Ajahn Chah went and stayed at, and went on his second trip to England. And then years later, it would have been, I think, about 1990, the year that Ajahn Jayasaro and I were on Tudong in India, whereas I was in Sarnath, kind of getting things organized to return to Thailand and staying at the Thai temple in Sarnath. And then this Tibetan monk showed up. I guess there's a Tibetan institute nearby. And he was, he got very excited. He said, so are you... are you from Thailand? Are you a disciple of Ajahn Chah? I said, yes, yeah. And he said, I was at Manjushri Institute when Ajahn Chah gave a talk, and he said all of us were just so inspired by his presence. He said, really, the good fortune of being a student of Ajahn Chah. So. Okay. Having been a teacher for many years now, I've been through my share of difficulties. At present, there are altogether about 40 branch monasteries of my monastery. I think now there's something over 300.
400.
Imagine the difficulties he'd be having. Sumpa Liam inherits it. But 40 branch monasteries of my monastery, Wat Nong Ma Pong. But even these days, I have followers who are hard to teach. Some know how to practice, but don't bother. Some don't know how, and don't try to find out. I don't know what to do with them. Why do human beings have minds like this? Being ignorant is not so good. But even when I tell them, they don't listen. I don't know what more I can do. People are so full of doubts in their practice. They're always doubting. They all want to go to Nibbana, but they don't want to walk the path. It's baffling. When I tell them to meditate, they're afraid. Or if not afraid, then just plain sleepy. Mostly they like to do the things I don't teach. When I've spoken with other teachers of the Dhamma, they have told me that their followers are just the same. This is the pain of being a teacher. The teaching I offer you today is a way to solve problems in the present moment, in this present life. Some people say that they have so much work to do, they have no time to practice the Dhamma. What can they do, they ask. What can we do, they ask. I tell them that practicing meditation is just like breathing. While working, we breathe. While sleeping, we breathe. While sitting down, we breathe. We have time to breathe because we see the importance of the breath. In the same way, if we see the importance of meditation practice, we will find the time to practice. Have any of you ever suffered? Have you ever been happy? Right here is the truth. This is where you must practice the Dhamma. Who is it who is happy? The mind is happy. Who suffers? The mind suffers. Wherever these things arise, that's where they cease. What is the cause of these things? This is our problem. If we know suffering, the cause of suffering, the end of suffering, and the way leading to the end of suffering, we can solve the problem. There are two kinds of suffering, ordinary suffering and the extraordinary kind. Ordinary suffering is a suffering that is the inherent nature of conditions. Standing is suffering, sitting is suffering, lying down is suffering. Even the Buddha experienced these things. He experienced comfort and pain, but he recognized them as conditions in nature. He knew how to overcome these ordinary, natural feelings of comfort and pain through understanding their true nature. Because he understood this natural suffering, those feelings didn't upset him. The important kind of suffering is the second kind, the suffering that creeps in from the outside, the extraordinary suffering. If we are sick, we may have to get an injection from the doctor. When the needle pierces the skin, there is some pain, which is only natural. When the needle is withdrawn, the pain disappears. This is like the ordinary kind of suffering. It's no problem. Everybody experiences it. The extraordinary suffering is the suffering that arises from what we call upadana, grasping onto things. This is like having an injection with a syringe filled with poison. This is no longer an ordinary kind of pain. It is the pain that ends in death. Wrong view, not knowing the impermanent nature of all conditioned things, is another kind of problem. Conditioned things are the realm of samsara, not wanting things to change. If we think like this, we must suffer. When we think that the body is ourselves or belongs to us, we are afraid when we see it change. Suppose we lost something. If we thought that object was really ours, we would brood over it. If we couldn't see it as a conditioned thing conforming to the laws of nature, we would experience suffering. But if you breathe in and don't breathe out, or breathe out and don't breathe in, can you live? Conditioned things must naturally change in this way. To see this is to see the Dhamma, to see anicca, change. We live dependent on this change. When we know how things are, then we can let go of them. The practice of Dhamma is to develop an understanding of the way things are so that suffering doesn't arise. If we think mistakenly, we put ourselves at odds with the world, at odds with the Dhamma and with the truth. Suppose you are sick and have to go into hospital. Most people think, please don't let me die. I want to get better. This is wrong thinking. It will lead to suffering. You have to think to yourself, if I recover, I recover. If I die, I die. This is right thinking, because you can't ultimately control conditions. If you think like this, whether you die or recover, you can't go wrong. You don't have to worry. Wanting to get better at all costs and afraid of dying, such is the mind that doesn't understand conditions. You should think, if I get better, that's fine. And if I don't get better, that's fine too. This way, we have tuned ourselves in to the way things are. The Buddha saw all this clearly. His teaching is always relevant, never outdated. It's still as true as it ever was. By taking this teaching to heart, we can gain the reward of peace and well-being. In the teachings, there is the reflection on not self. This is not myself. This does not belong to me. But people don't like this kind of teaching because they are attached to the idea of self. This is the cause of suffering. A woman asked me about how to deal with anger. I told her that the next time she gets angry, to wind up her alarm clock and put it in front of her. Then to give herself 2 hours for the anger to go away. If it was really her anger, she could probably tell it to go away like this. In 2 hours, be gone. But it isn't really ours to command. Sometimes in 2 hours, it's still here. At other times, in less than an hour, it's gone. Holding on to anger as a personal possession will cause suffering. If it really belonged to us, it would have to obey us. That it doesn't obey us means it's only a deception. Don't fall for it. Whether the mind is happy or sad, whether it loves or hates, don't fall for it. It's all a deception. When you are angry, does it feel good or bad? If it feels bad, why don't you throw that feeling away? How can you say that you are wise and intelligent when you hold on to such things? Since the day you were born, how many times has the mind tricked you into anger? Some days the mind can even cause a whole family to quarrel or cause you to cry all night. And yet we still continue to get angry. We still hold on to things and suffer. If you don't see suffering, you'll have to keep on suffering. If you see the suffering of anger, then just throw it away. If you don't throw it away, it'll go on causing suffering indefinitely. The world of samsara is like this. If we know the way it is, we can solve the problem. The Buddha's teaching states that there is no better means to overcome suffering than to see that, quote, this is not myself, this is not mine, unquote. This is the greatest method. But we don't usually pay attention to this. When suffering arises, we simply cry over it without learning from it. We must take a good hard look at these things to develop the Buddho, the one who knows. Now I'm going to give you some Dhamma that's outside the scriptures. Most people read the scriptures but don't see the Dhamma. They miss the point or don't understand. Suppose two people are walking together and see a duck and a chicken. One of them says, why can't that chicken be like the duck? And why can't the duck be like the chicken? What they want is impossible. They could wish for the duck to be a chicken and the chicken to be a duck for the rest of their life, but it would not come to pass because the chicken is a chicken and the duck is a duck. As long as they continue to think like that, they would suffer. The other person sees that the chicken is a chicken and the duck is a duck, and that's all there is to it. No problem. In the same way, the law of anicca states that all things are impermanent. If you want things to be permanent, you're going to suffer. One who sees that things are naturally impermanent will be at ease and free from conflict. The one who wants things to be permanent is going to have conflict and maybe even lose sleep over it. If you want to know the Dhamma, where do you look? You must look within the body and the mind. You won't find it on a bookshelf. To really see the Dhamma, you have to look within your own body and mind. There are only these two things. The mind is not visible to the physical eye. It must be seen with, quote-unquote, the mind's eye. The Dhamma that is in the body must be seen in the body. And with what do we look at the body? We look at the body with the mind. You won't find the Dhamma by looking anywhere else, because both happiness and suffering arise right here. Or maybe you've seen happiness arising in the trees, or from the rivers, or the weather. Happiness and suffering are feelings that arise in our own bodies and minds. Therefore, the Buddha tells us to know the Dhamma right here. Someone may tell you to look for the Dhamma in books, but if you think that this is where the Dhamma really is, you'll never find it. If you look in books, then you must reflect on those teachings inwardly. Only then can you understand the Dhamma, for it exists right here in this body and mind of ours. When we do this, wisdom will arise in our minds. Then no matter where we look, there is Dhamma. We will see anicca, dukkha, and anatta at all times. But we don't see this. We always see things as being ourself and belonging to us. This means that we don't see the truth about conventional reality. For example, all of us sitting here have names. Names are a convention. Of course, it's useful to have names. Four men, A, B, C, and D, must each have an individual name for convenience in communicating and working together. If we want to speak to Mr. A, we can call out to Mr. A and he will come, not the others. This is the convenience of convention. But when we look deeply into the matter, we will see that really there isn't anybody there. We will see transcendence. There is only earth, water, wind, and fire, the four elements. This is all there is to this body of ours. But we don't see it in this way because of the power of attavadupadana, or clinging to selfhood, or the assumption of self. If we were to look clearly, we would see that there isn't really much to what we call a person. The solid part is the earth element, the fluid part is the water element, the part that consists of air and gas, together with currents of energy coursing through the body, is called the wind element, and the part that provides heat is called the fire element. When earth, water, wind, and fire are brought together, they are called a human being. When we break things down and see that there are only these four elements, where is the person to be found? That's why the Buddha taught that there is no higher practice than to see that this, quote, this is not myself and does not belong to me, unquote. Me and mine are simply conventions. If we understand everything clearly in this way, we will be at peace. If we realize in the present moment the truth of impermanence, that things are not ourself and do not belong to us, then when they disintegrate, we are at peace with them. They are merely the elements of earth, water, wind, and fire. It's difficult to see this, but it's not beyond our ability. If we succeed, we will find contentment. We will have... We will have less anger, greed, and delusion. There will always be Dhamma in our hearts. There will be no need for jealousy and spite, because everybody is simply earth, water, wind, and fire. There's nothing more to them than this. When we accept this fact, we will see the truth of the Buddha's teaching. If we could see the truth of the Buddhist teaching, we wouldn't have to use up so many teachers. It wouldn't be necessary to listen to teachings every day. When we understand, we simply do what's required of us. But what makes people so difficult to teach is that they don't accept the teaching and argue with the teachings and the teaching. In front of the teacher, they behave all right, but behind his back, they become like thieves. People in Thailand are like this, and that's why they need so many teachers. If you're not careful, you won't see the Dhamma. You must be circumspect, taking the teaching and considering it careful. Considering it carefully. Is this flower pretty? Do you see the ugliness within it? How long will it stay pretty? How will it look later? Why does it change so? In 3 or 4 days, when it loses its beauty, won't you have to throw it out? People are attached to people are attached to beauty, attached to goodness. If anything is good, they just fall for it completely. The Buddha tells us to look at pretty things as just pretty, without becoming attached to them. If there is a pleasant feeling, we shouldn't fall for it. Goodness is not a sure thing. Beauty is not a sure thing. Nothing is certain. This is the truth. Things that aren't true, such as beauty, are things that change. The only truth that beauty has lies in its constant changing. If we believe that things really are beautiful, when their beauty fades, our mind loses its beauty too. When things are no longer good, our mind loses its goodness too. We invest our minds in material things in this way. When they are destroyed or damaged, we suffer because we have clung to them as being our own. The Buddha tells us to see that these things are simply constructs of nature. Beauty appears and soon fades. To see this is to have wisdom. If we think something is pretty, we should tell ourselves it isn't. If we think something is ugly, we should tell ourselves it isn't. Try to see things in this way. Constantly reflect in this way. We will see the truth within untrue things. See the certainty within the things that are uncertain. I have been explaining the way to understand suffering, what causes suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the way leading to the cessation of suffering. When you know suffering, you should throw it out. Knowing the cause of suffering, you should throw it out. Practice to see the cessation of suffering. See anicca, dukkha, and anatta, and suffering will cease. What are we practicing for? We are practicing in order to relinquish, not to gain something. A woman told me that she was suffering. When I asked her what she wanted, she said she wanted to be enlightened. As long as you want to be enlightened, I replied, you'll never become enlightened. Don't want anything. When we know the truth of suffering, we throw out suffering. When we know the cause of suffering, then we don't create those causes, but instead practice to bring suffering to its cessation. The practice leading to the cessation of suffering is to see that this is, quote, this is not a self, this is not me or mine, unquote. Seeing in this way enables suffering to cease. It's like reaching our destination and stopping. That's cessation. That's getting close to nibbana. To put it another way, going forward is suffering, retreating is suffering, and stopping is suffering. Not going forward, not retreating, and not stopping. When that happens, is anything left? Body and mind cease here. This is the cessation of suffering. Hard to understand, isn't it? But if we diligently and consistently study this teaching, we will transcend things and reach understanding. There will be cessation. This is the ultimate teaching of the Buddha, the finishing point. The Buddha's teaching finishes at the point of total relinquishment. Don't be in a hurry to judge whether this teaching is right or wrong. Just listen to it first. If I were to give you a fruit and tell you it's delicious, you should take note of my words, but not believe me unquestioningly, because you haven't tasted it yet. If you want to know whether the fruit is sweet or sour, you should cut off a slice and taste it. Then you'll know. The same goes for the teaching I've just given you. Don't throw away this fruit. Keep it and taste it. Know it for yourself. The Buddha didn't have a teacher, you know. An ascetic once asked him who his teacher was, and the Buddha answered that he didn't have one. The ascetic just walked off, shaking his head. The Buddha was being too honest. He was speaking to one who couldn't know or accept the truth. That's why I tell you not to believe me. The Buddha said that simply to believe others is foolish, because there is no clear knowing within. That's why the Buddha said, I have no teacher. This is the truth, but you should understand this correctly so as not to disrespect your teacher. Don't go saying, I have no teacher. You must rely on your teacher to tell you what is right and wrong, and then you must practice accordingly. In the Buddha's time, there were disciples of the Buddha who didn't like him, because the Buddha exhorted them to be diligent, to be heedful. Those who were lazy were afraid of the Buddha and resented him. When he died, one group of disciples cried and were distressed that they would no longer have the Buddha to guide them. Another group of disciples was pleased and relieved that they would no longer have the Buddha on their backs telling them what to do. A third group of disciples was equanimous, having reflected on the truth that what arises passes away as a natural consequence. Which group do you identify with? These days, things aren't much different. All teachers have some followers who resent them. They might not show it outwardly, but it's there in the mind. It's normal for people who still have defilements to feel this way. Even the Buddha had people hating him. I have followers who resent me. I tell them to give up unwholesomeness, but since they cherish their unwholesome actions, they hate me. There are plenty of people like this. Those of you who are intelligent will make yourselves firm in the practice of Dhamma.
It's just wonderful to hear Ajahn Chah's sort of brutal honesty about what it's like being a teacher.
Yes, yeah. Yes, he made, I think in the Thai it's a little bit clearer, sort of, you know. I talked with the Ajahn here and he said, yeah, my students are just like that. Yeah.
One thing I've been reflecting about being a teacher is, first I read, when I read or heard that Ajahn Amaro has been not sitting and not lying down for 2 years, I was very impressed. And then thinking about that, Mopo Sumedho watched Ajahn Amaro doing for some other doing this for 2 years and kind of in the end saying, finally you stop it. I think it's very impressive this, you need to be so, like, why do you let people make their own experience, right?
Yes, I mean, it's part of a, how do you say, the duty or skill of a teacher is letting people gain their own experience, let them make their own mistakes, but also try to find ways to reflect on things without trying to push or control. It's a delicate balance, because you can be too concerned about people. You're not wanting people to suffer or make difficulties for themselves. Really want them to see and understand. And And you can't really do it anyway. So you want to give people space to both have some reflections or considerations, but also to make their own mistakes.
It was 3.5 years. Just for the sake of just accuracy.
Okay, continue on. Given the total nature of this letting go, does anything remain? The repeated refrains included in the descriptions of awakening by those who have attained it suggest at least one thing. Those who have been liberated know they have been liberated. This aspect of knowing for oneself is a characteristic of the Dhamma. Pachatangwe ditabo winyuhi, to be personally experienced by the wise. And this next quote is from Majjhima 1.12, which is the Chabbisodana Sutta, the Sixfold Purity. And in it, the Buddha explains how a bhikkhu should be interrogated when he claims final knowledge and how he would answer if his claim is genuine. And just as I read through it, just sort of like the different bases of insight and relinquishment are notable, just in how thorough the Buddha approaches it, and in his, but also in their, how do you say, seeming ordinariness. This isn't. Anyway, I'll go through it. Bhikkhus. When a bhikkhu is one with taints destroyed, who has lived the holy life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden, reached the true goal, destroyed the fetters of being, and is completely liberated through final knowledge, this is the nature of his answer. Friends, regarding the scene, I abide unattracted, unrepelled, independent, detached, free, dissociated, with a mind rid of barriers. Regarding the heard, regarding the sensed, regarding the cognized, I abide unattracted, unrepelled, independent, detached, free, dissociated, with a mind rid of barriers. It is by knowing thus, seeing thus, regarding these four kinds of expression, that through not clinging, my mind is liberated from the taints. Bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu is one with taints destroyed, and is completely liberated through final knowledge, this is the nature of his answer. Friends, having known material forms to be feeble, fading away, and comfortless, with the destruction, fading away, cessation, giving up, and relinquishing of attraction and clinging regarding material form, of mental standpoints, adherences, and underlying tendencies regarding material form, I have understood that my mind is liberated. Friends, having known feeling, having known perception, having known formations, having known consciousness to be feeble, fading away, and comfortless, with the destruction, fading away, cessation, giving up, and relinquishing of attraction and clinging regarding consciousness, of mental standpoints, adherences, and underlying tendencies regarding consciousness, I have understood that my mind is liberated. It is by knowing thus, seeing thus, regarding these five aggregates affected by clinging, that through not clinging, my mind is liberated from the taints. Bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu is one with taints destroyed and is completely liberated through final knowledge, this is the nature of his answer. I have treated the earth element as not self, with no self based on the earth element. And with the destruction, fading away, cessation, giving up, and relinquishing of attraction and clinging based on the earth element of mental standpoints, adherences, and underlying tendencies based on the earth element, I have understood that my mind is liberated. Friends, I have treated the water element, the fire element, the air element, the space element, the consciousness element as not self, with no self based on the consciousness element. And with the destruction, fading away, cessation, giving up, and relinquishing of attraction and clinging based on the consciousness element of mental standpoints, adherences, and underlying tendencies based on the consciousness element, I have understood that my mind is liberated. It is by knowing thus, seeing thus, regarding these six elements, that through not clinging, my mind is liberated from the taints. Because when a bhikkhu is one with taints destroyed and is completely liberated through final knowledge, this is the nature of his answer. Friends, with the destruction, fading away, cessation, giving up, and relinquishing of desire, lust, delight, craving, attraction, and clinging, and of mental standpoints, adherences, and underlying tendencies regarding the I, forms, I consciousness, and things cognizable by the mind through I consciousness, I have understood that my mind is liberated. With the destruction, fading away, cessation, giving up, and relinquishing of desire, lust, delight, craving, attraction, and clinging, and of mental standpoints, adherences, and underlying tendencies regarding the ear, sounds, ear consciousness, and things cognizable by the mind through ear consciousness, regarding the nose, odors, nose consciousness, and things cognizable by the mind through nose consciousness, regarding the tongue, flavors, tongue consciousness, and things cognizable by the mind through tongue consciousness, regarding the body, tangibles, body consciousness, and things cognizable by the mind through body consciousness, regarding the mind, mind objects, mind consciousness, and things cognizable by the mind through mind consciousness, I have understood that my mind is liberated. It is by knowing thus, seeing thus, regarding these six internal and external bases, that through not clinging, my mind is liberated from the taints. So it's just, so it's like that basis of insight and letting go is just seeing through these different elements of of experience and what we base it on. That was just the six senses and their objects and the feelings that arise through that. Which is the first one is somewhat similar in the sense, but it's like it's a different way of approaching it. The seen, heard, sensed, and cognized is a shorthand for the avenues of how we experience the world around us. And then of course the five khandhas and the different elements. These are all things we've heard of and know, but it's like realizing that there's just the not being pulled into the attachment and clinging that arise on the basis of that.
It's also kind of interesting how the different modes.
Yeah,
different people to choose different angles of approach, and it's a bit reminiscent of that Mahago Singha Sutta when the forest is illuminated by the moonlight, and the elders go around. It starts off, I think, with Ananda thinking, "Oh, what a beautiful moonlit night! The forest is filled with fragrance, and what kind of a monk would illuminate the forest on a night like this." And then they go to see Venerable Sariputta, and then Sariputta talks about, one who can enter into any state of meditation, you know, at will. They go to see see Mahamoggallana, who talks about we are a monk who can visit all sorts of different realms of existence, and then and they each have their own speciality, and each one has got their kind of favored mode of activity. And Mahakasapa is that one who wears rag robes and is practices the Dutangas, and then so it's kind of a unique sutta where each of these arahants, I think Ananda is the only non-arahant in the group, and they each sort of talk about their own speciality or their own sort of favorite angle of approach, or what they've put most of attention into and have developed accomplishment in that area. And when they go to see the master, they go to the Buddha, and they think, oh, well, what would he say? And then it's very interesting because it's one of the few places where the Buddha highlights the quality of adhitana. That's the way he saw his own speciality was, as it were, as like one who would sit down and say, I will not move from this spot until my blood dries up and my bones turn to dust until I've realized full and complete enlightenment. So it's that kind of various different angles that people use and specialize in, and then also become the themes for Dhamma teachings.
Right. And it's also how they... There's another sutta where the different groups of personalities are gravitate toward to the different personalities of the teachers, and it's just natural. It's very very human. Very human.
Where is that one?
Somewhere. The Gosinga Grove.
Yeah, it's looking for the Gosinga, Mahagosinga Sutra.
Yeah.
Anyway, please carry on.
Yeah, okay.
Here it is, 32.
Majima 32.
Please, yeah, carry on.
Yeah, okay. Okay, next, just carrying straight on, illustrating that's a similar point, nature of insight. And this is from Anguttara 10, Sutta number 7, once the Venerable Ananda approached the Venerable Sariputta and asked, can it be, friend Sariputta, that a monk attains to such a concentration of mind that in earth he is not percipient of earth, nor in water is he percipient of water, nor in fire, air, or the base of the infinity of space, base of the infinity of consciousness, base of the of nothingness, the base of neither perception nor non-perception, is he percipient of all these, nor is he percipient of this world or a world beyond, but yet he is percipient. So that's an undesired. Can somebody have some kind of concentration or focus of attention either on the four elements or in terms of the form realm or the formless attainments of the one, refined states of consciousness and concentration, and can they be sort of percipient of all these, but also not, but still, yeah, but also that they're not sort of attending to that. You've got that as a base, but then you're not having to attend to it, but still percipient. Yes, friend Ananda, he can attain to such a concentration of mind. But how, friend Sariputta, can a monk attain to such a concentration of mind? Once, friend Ananda, I lived here in Savatthi in the dark forest. There I attained to such a concentration of mind that in earth I was not percipient of earth, and within all of those different experiences of the elements of the of states of concentration, I was not percipient of these, but I was I percipient of this world or a world beyond, and yet I was percipient. But what was the Venerable Sariputta percipient of on that occasion? Nibbana is cessation of becoming. Nibbana is cessation of becoming. One such perception arose in me, and another such perception ceased. Just as, friend Ananda, from a fire of faggots, one flame arises. So, just a wood stick, a stick wood fire. One arises and another flame ceases. Even so, Nibbana is cessation of becoming. Nibbana is cessation of becoming. One such perception arose in me and another such perception ceased. On that occasion, friend, I perceived that Nibbana is the cessation of becoming. So that that Sariputta is basically describing his understanding or his realization or his sense of how one can be approaching that realization of Nibbana, and it just is the mind not moving out. There is this cessation of becoming, but the mind is still aware, it's still present. And I think this is something that like Ajahn Chah talks about all the time, just how important it is that there's always the need for awareness, and even if it's to the on a subtle level of okay, there's I'm being aware of oh, this is a cessation of becoming, a cessation of movement of mind, cessation of the sense of I, me, and mine, and it's but it, when it's that is like capable of that.
There's also, isn't there, a dialogue between Mahakotita and Venerable Sariputta, and that's similar, very similar vein, I think.
Could be. There's lots of dialogues between them.
Bhava Nirodho Nibbanang is the the Pali for that. So that's,
yes, yeah.
And in terms of themes of meditation, that's one I've used a lot, just that simple phrase.
Yes.
You know, Nibbana is the cessation of becoming. Like, that's
just that. It just definitely stops the mind.
It does. It does. Pavani Rodo Nibbana.
Yes.
I'm just reminded of the last testament of a well-known teacher, a revered teacher, and he, it was a short letter, but the essence of it came down to rest in purity and evenness,
mm-hmm.
and do something for the benefit of others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's nothing much to do, really. And say, it's just there is this incredible directness and simplicity that is the essence of insight, even though, of course. Yeah, I mean, Tripitaka is vast, but still there is this incredible straightforwardness of the essence of realization. There's also something I've been thinking of was an exchange that Lumpu Dun had. I mean, it's kind of similar, but especially this sense of knowing that is highlighted, and this is from that Atulo. And anyway, I'll read the. It's an account by a disciple of Lupudun. I remember that in 1976, two meditation teachers from the northern part of the Northeast came to pay their respects to Lumpu. The way they discussed the practice with him was very delightful and inspiring. They described the virtues and attainments of the different ajahns with whom they had lived and practiced for a long time, saying that that ajahn had concentration as his constant mental dwelling, that this ajahn dwelled in the Brahma Viharas, which is why so many people respected them. That Lumpa dwelled in the limitless Brahma attitudes, which is why there was no limit to the number of students he had, and why he was always safe from danger. Lumpudun said, "Whatever level a monk has reached, as far as I'm concerned, he's welcome to dwell there. As for me, I dwell with knowing." When those two monks heard Lumpu say that he dwelled with knowing, they were silent for a moment and then asked him to explain what dwelling with knowing was like. Lumpu explained, "Knowing is the normality of mind that's empty, bright, pure, that has stopped fabricating, stopped searching, stopped all mental motions, having nothing, not attached to anything at all." It's very, I've always found that really beautiful.
Yes, yes, wonderful.
Yeah.
Is that from the Ajahn Tanisro translation?
Or it is. It's from the Gifts He Left Behind. It's a great little book.
We have quite a lot of copies of that, I think.
Yeah.
I think in the bookstore we have had.
Yeah. No, they're great. I think it's close enough to 7 to wrap it up, if it's...